ready for this discussion.
Is Marco?
Oh.
Hello.
I'm lighting here.
Yeah, I can do the same. I don't know if it's too bright in the background for you guys. The halo effect.
I think Heather said she would probably join us this morning, but I don't know. I haven't heard. No, Pat can't, and I know that Anna can't. Can't remember. Jocelyn, I think Jocelyn can't either. So might be just the three of us with Heather.
Okay.
Did John mention he was unable to?
Oh, John probably. I think he's going to probably come. Usually does. Oh, Cora's here. Good. Hi, Cora.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
You got your hair cut.
I did get my hair cut. It feel like it's been almost shaved off, like a crew cut or something, you know? I feel naked, you know?
It looks really nice.
I like the curves, though.
Yeah.
Nice flow there.
And this little tuft at the top that won't seem to behave.
Oh. I'm usually hesitant to share my dreams, but I did have a dream last week, Jeffrey, that you were, it was like a TED Talk presentation, and you were in a full black leather suit, similar Whoa. To what you designed, and you did have a different hairdo, but not, it was more of a mohawk spike.
It's
very strange.
Really?
Well, I've never done a TED Talk. They never asked me.
If you ever do, you'll need a full black leather suit.
Okay, I'll go for that. Yeah.
Do we know who we're expecting today?
I think Heather was planning to come, and Johnny usually comes. I don't think he said anything about not coming, so.
Okay.
But I think that'll be it.
You mentioned this last week, but the topic I think was just created.
I just created it yesterday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We could get started maybe. I didn't really prepare anything for today, but since I was reading the Tao Te Ching this week and it's very minor gesture style, I thought I'd read one excerpt from the Tao Te Ching to start us off this morning. So it's verse 63. It's from the Le Guin version. Now, it's interesting because I've been looking into the different translations of the Tao Te Ching. Hi, Johnny. So I was just going to start off with a reading from the Tao Te Ching because that's what I've been reading this week. And I was just saying that there are several different translations, but the Le Guin version is really interesting because she actually admits that she doesn't understand Chinese. So she didn't translate it. She worked from 15 different translations and she came up with a version that speaks to her in a more poetic language. So it's kind of a rewriting of other translators, which is a kind of an interesting way to do it. Anyway, so it's verse 63 from Le Guin's version. So, do without doing, act without action, savor the flavorless, treat the small as large, the few as many, meet injury with the power of goodness, study the hard while it's easy, do big things while they're small. The hardest jobs in the world start out easy. The great affairs of the world start small. So the wise soul, by never dealing with great things, gets great things done. now, since taking things too lightly makes them worthless, and taking things too easy makes them hard, the wise soul, by treating the easy as hard, doesn't find anything hard.
Do you mind repeating the final three or four lines there, starting with the
So the wise soul, by never dealing with great things, gets great things done. Now, since taking things too lightly makes them worthless, and taking things too easy makes them hard, the wise soul, by treating the easy as hard, doesn't find anything hard. It's actually quite a complex. What's interesting about the Le Guin version is she comments it, but they're more kind of personal comments than they are scholarly academic comments, you know, so they're sort of, oh, I like this one, or this one is interesting because, and these kinds of comments, they're interesting. And she says this one is interesting because it combines two proverbs. Requite injuries with good deeds is the first. And then she mentions the fact that Lao Tzu uses the word te to mean goodness, but te is also the word for power, or the Tao, or power, I think, the power of the way. So it's this slide between goodness and power, which is interesting. And then then she says, so having neatly annexed the golden rule, he goes on to the proverb about taking things too lightly and plays paradox with it. That's Le Guin's comment about it. So it's quite a complex little piece.
I have her translation here, and it has a CD. So she gives a performance of it.
Oh, wow. That would be cool.
Yeah. I haven't listened to it yet. I've read her translation, but I have to listen to her voice. And I think she has a jazz combo behind her.
Okay.
Very, very eclectic Le Guin. Well, I was just responding to you, Jeffrey, a comment that you made on the cafe. And you quoted Le Guin in the comment. And I had just commented upon your comment when I started this. And then there you are, quoting Le Guin. But I had a response to the conversation that we had yesterday. And also, in that conversation we had yesterday in the cafe, we referenced some of the conversations that have been generated here.
Right. From.
So I think that what's happening between these different groups with different kinds of purposes actually kind of cross-fertilizes in creative ways. But one of the things that, if you don't mind me, I hope I'm not contaminating this space that happened in that space. But I think it's going to be hard to separate that out because we all are participating in multiple spaces. But the Marco was talking about referring to ultimate reality. And I sort of bristled with that. And I was, and some others of us were talking about affective attunement to the field. And I'm just wondering now, as I reflect on that conversation and hearing the quotes from Le Guin, is that she could do both at the same time, I think. And I think Lao Tzu could as well. And maybe these are just poetic procedures that we're trying to co-compose, perhaps, to borrow some of Aaron's language, or co-facilitate these poetic procedures. And may I quote someone very briefly, because I think this is appropriate to what, as we're summing up this adventure we've done with Aaron, something that her partner Masumi, Brian Masumi, says about their work together at the Sense Lab and what they're trying to do. If anything goes, nothing will come. What we do is set in place poetico-procedurally enabling constraints. These are mechanisms designed to set certain conditions in place, allowing for an inventive interaction to occur that's something like a structured improvisation. The situation is positively constrained, conditioned in a way that we hope will create the conditions for a process of collective expression to unfold. So, and he says, this is in his book, Politics of Affect, which I quoted from yesterday in the cafe. But I think this this opens up all kinds of different ways of languaging these kinds of these co-facilitation, co-composing, coming together in a collective way and holding an intention. I mean, these are, and paying attention to what others are paying attention to. I mean, this is really what politics is doing. And if our politics are impoverished, maybe we need to, and as I believe many of us believe that our politics are in big trouble, how can we come together in maybe these small experimental groups such as this to do something different? How can we, you know, use our imaginations? How can we share power? How can we deal with constraints that are creative, that bring out things that would not emerge if we hadn't given some structure to our improvisations? So I think the difference between a mess, a total mess, and an artful improvisation is structure. And I think, how do we do that together rather than one person or group of persons exposing a structure? I think that's a huge challenge. So thank you for this chance to rehearse.
Is that...
Go ahead.
I had a question. Does this go along with mediation? Is that something?
That's the chapter that I'm quoting from. Masumi and Aaron Manning, they're in an interview together, and the title of the interview is Immediation.
Which I love strangely just happened to watch right before this, so it was
cool. Some resonances happening here.
Can you clarify, is that in mediation, two words in mediation, or is it?
It's one word.
Mediation.
Two M's.
I M M E D I T I O N. In mediation.
Okay.
I think that's a new word, isn't it?
That sounds like a neologism.
Yeah.
A nice one.
Yeah.
I just had one brief thing to say about that, which was one of the questions I had was, so in the talk, and maybe that same chapter, if it's just a transcript of the talk, they talk about how the two of them can mediate together, or couples in general can do that through love, through knowledge of each other, through their one movement. And they mention in the talk that if you're at a party with a couple, you just see that they work together, even if they're separate in the party, or even if they're miles apart, there's still some sort of connection. So the same question comes up with, how do we do this through a group, which we all know each other here somewhat. So it's a question that keeps coming up for me too. That's all I have to say.
And just adding on to that, I hear what you're saying, John, in this forum of speaking to one another, and where all of these minor gestures and glimpses into something else and these kinds of conversations that we're having, that's a very interesting question for me, is how does it unfold? How does it begin to trickle out from these conversations and this forum without doing what you talked about, John, where you start imposing a structure on it, where you start saying, okay, so if this is what we're talking about, this is what we're going to do. Like, how do we stay close to what Aaron is talking about, in the sense that these minor gestures, in a sense, start to take their own life without imposing ourselves upon it? So I asked the group that question, like, from these conversations, what are your thoughts around how this begins to trickle or reinvent itself so that it moves into a larger form where it does start to push, that's not the right word, where it starts to affect other possibilities. It's a big question.
Very big question, yeah. Well, I think there's only hints and guesses and abductive moves. I think Joseph Chilton, was it Peirce? Yeah, Peirce, American philosopher. He talks about there's the abductive, well, the deductive, the inductive, and the abductive.
Yeah, yeah.
He thinks everything new comes out of the abductive move, which is basically a guess.
Right.
Turn left, turn right. Well, I don't know. I'm just going to guess it should go that way. Yeah. And I think that's where, if we could cultivate that without operationalizing it in a kind of what I think cognocentric capitalist procedures basically are taking the poetry out of all of this and just imposing this neoliberal stamp on our organizations. And I think that's creating enormous fragility in all of our systems, because where these sister systems came from or where they're going to fulfill some corporate CEO's dream of getting his bonus this trimester. You know? I mean, those kind of short-term focuses, I think, when driven by a politics that relies on a kind of neo-Darwin ethic, is a fatally, fatally flawed kind of strategy. So I don't know. But I think when I don't know, I think that's a good sign. Because when we come to our maps and say, gee, I just don't know. So that's where I think if we can guess in a cultivated, when our collective environments sort of cultivate that I don't know, I'm not sure, I'm a little baffled here. I think that would be a really good place for us to hang out rather than, you know, turn it into a product. So I think this process orientation that I think Aaron is exploring in this book is very stimulating to me, because it seems like artists and poets and performers and moms and dads and anyone who has to take care of another person is very aware that it's a process. You can't just say, this is what I want and this is how I'm going to get it, because it just doesn't work that way.
Well, it even goes back to the first two lines that Jeffrey read. It's do without doing and act without acting. Really, what it is.
And I do think that I like this poetic procedures, which you pulled out of Masumi. But it also relates to the field idea that we've been playing around with through a number of our conversations. And the poetic field is all because of the work on quantum poetics and field poetics. So I agree that I don't know is a good place to be. And poetics is, and poetry is a kind of thing that emerges from I don't know without pushing structure. You know, I mean, you can do it with structure. You can push structure in poetry, but it usually doesn't work very well.
Well, form, though, is important. And sometimes the constraint of a form, even a pre-existing, even a canonical form, can channel creativity and channel energies in a certain way. It can require invention because there's the forcing of a particularity. I think part of what is interesting and beautiful about the Tao Te Ching is that it's constantly playing with form. It's constantly kind of positing a form and then undoing the form in the same breath. So savoring the savorless, for example. The ultimate reality that can be named is not the ultimate reality. So something is always being undone, even in its doing. And so Aaron, for example, I think to bring in the text, she makes distinctions between method, procedure, and she plays with form, I think. She sets up structures, but she doesn't set up ultimate structures. They're structures which allow themselves to be deconstructed and reconstructed. I was listening to a talk she did. It was a kind of a TED talk, actually, it was literally a TED talk, a TEDx talk or something with Brian Massumi. And she was describing a project that they did together through the Sense Lab. And it involved, I didn't totally understand it, but it involved something that she called molecules and different cells, different small groups in different geographic locations working on, I'm going to mangle exactly what she said, but essentially working with their own procedures and processes relating to their local context and relating to their relationships with one another, but then feeding through what Massumi called an emissary. Emissaries feeding these molecules to each other and creating these, I guess, linkages. Again, I didn't, you know, this was just in the context of a TED talk. It was an example she was giving of their process. But I think maybe something along those lines where like in principle there's autonomy amongst local groups or in local contexts. But then there's this communal mechanism whereby those local contexts can communicate with each other and inform each other. I mean, much like we are sort of doing here with respect to the minor gesture in the Cosmos Cafe, and that in that conversation we were hearkening to another series of conversations with around Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo's work. So I think these start to link up, and it becomes, to use maybe an overused word, rhizomatic, in the sense that there isn't exactly a hierarchical relationship between them, but there's a density of interconnections. And I think something comes from the density of interconnections between diverse contexts. I think that's very neurological, actually, like the way that, as I understand, you know, our neurons work is that they mesh with each other. And the stronger the mesh, or the more dense the mesh, the stronger the cognition or affect or whatever is associated with that particular brain region.
I could respond to that, but is there anyone who hasn't spoken yet? Have we?
No, I think we all.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
Okay. This is sort of the big chunk. I'm trying to chunk it down. Practice what I preach. It isn't that easy, actually. Actually, chunking down and chunking slow is a very big challenge. Without a structured procedure, which is why I've been using clean language as much as I can when I feel like we're in concept land, and doing a little bit of just some clean language around that, I think can hopefully slow down and help us chunk at maybe that micro perceptual level. Because I think the micro perceptual is where all the action is. I just wanted to improvise a little bit around something that came up, and I think two sessions ago, and Marco was proposing to do an exercise with a group where, and he wanted to explore some kind of suck state. I think it was disability. Was that it, Marco? I think he wanted to explore disability. And he had a kind of a loose procedure, and he wanted to sort of get this going. And I felt a strong affective, it was something I couldn't quite put into words, but I just had this a negative affect around this. And we explored it, but I think we could go back to that and look at it a little differently than after we finish this book, and maybe something new will come out of that. I wouldn't call it an impasse at all, or even, it wasn't even a conflict. But I think there's this But it is about, you mentioned density. And for me, a synonym for density, and I may be wrong, this just may be my peculiar response to density, is intensity. And density and intensity are very sort of synonymous for me. Because when it gets really thick and lots of different loops and they're all tying themselves up into knots, it gets in my body. And I think that's what I refer to as, like, I have a knot in my chest, I have a knot in my gut. I don't like this feeling. And I turned it into a metaphor. It's like, well, there's a tornado and I'm running towards an underground shelter, and it's very tight and everyone is very tense as this huge tornado is coming at us. So I was able to facilitate my own process. And in that process, I probably was generating some affects that I think each person in our group can respond to in any way that they want. But I think that's kind of useful, that I had a procedure for working with those affects, and I was able to communicate that. But that's because I've practiced with in a structured way how to explore these micro, at the micro perceptive level, before it gets turned into concepts. I'm just saying that it has something to do with intensity and the sort of willingness to hang out with others with that kind of intensity. And intensity can be very pleasant, and it can also be totally awful. It's sort of not that important. I think as we start to look at the pre-individual and the relationship, the many relationships between this pre-individual and this trans-individual and the subject. And I think Simon Don and Aaron Manning consistently point out this confusion that we take the pre-individual, which we're not responsible for the subject, which we claim to be responsible for. So the subject is always in this kind of quasi-confused delusional state. And I think the trans individual is what holds that open connection to the field. And that's to always be in the middle of the mess, you know, rather than floating above in some concept land that calls all the shots. So I have much more to say about this, but I think that this was for me a very powerful co-composing, and I'm very grateful to everyone in the group for creating the conditions so that this kind of emergence can happen. And I hope we can do more of that. You know, that is something that I would like to create a structure for that kind of possibility. So that's something new. Like he says, if everything is allowed, nothing new will come. So I think these kind of structured poetic procedures can create artful improvisations rather than just a big mess.
It's interesting because I agree, Johnny, that session was a particularly strong session among us, brought issues to the surface that were maybe going on behind some of the other conversations and had never been named or brought to the surface. One of the things I noticed while I was listening to you is that in this kind of virtual room where we're each in our own space and we're sharing through this video connection. Normally when I'm sitting in a group of people who I don't know all that well, I'm not very comfortable. In fact, I'm usually, I mean, I, you know, obviously if I'm in charge of the group, like I sort of in principle was the case here, you know, I will act forward out of my space in terms of managing the group or whatever, but I'm not very comfortable emotionally in that kind of a setting. But I'm noticing that in this context, I'm more comfortable than I normally would be. I mean, obviously we've gotten to know each other a bit through these different conversations, and that's part of what's going on. But I think it's more than that. I think the fact that I am sitting in a comfortable space in my home with my own people around me and video chatting with the group gives a different sense of comfort than if I'm actually in a room with a group of people that, you know, I only know in moderate ways, let's say. So I think there's something going on there in terms of the emotional dynamics of what's going on in these conversations. So I just thought I'd mention that.
And I just wanted to point out a feature of our collective landscape, our attunement to the field. I thought it was very poignant when we're talking about first person. The first person isn't always personal. And you brought forward, and the third person isn't always impersonal, you know, or purely objective. And going between first person and third person, I think a new kind of health could emerge. I think you really embodied that when you told that story, that story about being imprisoned in the American prison, and your affiliation with the with a social movement that was started very small but had sort of like a butterfly effect.
Mm.
And I felt that first person account, there was no yelling and screaming or bursting into tears, but there was a strong affective tone that was registered, which I believe is what is coming from the field. So I think not all first person accounts, of course, are relevant. We could talk about going shopping or whatever. But I think that some first person accounts that are connected to the field are extremely important for us to pay attention to, as it is so much easier because we've been entrained and enculturated to go into third person and footnotes and this authority said this and that authority said that. And what do you think this authority means when he objects to what that authority means? And it's like, after a while, it's just, like Aaron says, you know, you listen to a lot of philosophy. These philosophy concerts, everyone's eyes glaze over. They start looking like zombies. And I think she was being amusing, but I think there's some truth to that. And why, you know, she complements her philosophical inquiry with being a seamstress, you know, sewing and creating designs for a human shape and motion. So I think that's that in between the third person objective tone and that first person, a relevant first person, and maybe a disciplined first person. I think it is a kind of poetics involved in engaging others in an affective zone. I think there's some people tremendously artistic in that way. So I hope we can do all of it well and do all of it even a little bit better, you know, each time we try, because it's, unless we point this out to one another, I think it's easy to just like, it perishes. And it's, everything's going to perish, but it perishes before it's able to leave some kind of residue that can then become an aspect of the next phase. And that's why I think our technology is brilliant, but our technology is pretty bad at capturing that which is perishing before something else new emerges. And actually the new that they're claiming is new isn't actually that new. It's pretty old. It's just been repackaged to look kind of fancier than it actually is. So anyway, I'm just sharing that, how much you impacted me by that personal experience. Thanks.
like to reflect back on that session a couple of weeks ago. And also bring it back to Aaron's book. One thought that I've come back to over and over as we've been reading this has been the idea that we're doing this in the act. The name of her book series is Thought in the Act. And the name of the chapter that we were covering, I think, that week was In the Act, The Shape of Precarity. And I thought that was an interesting experience because I kind of felt myself, and I think part of what John was reacting to was a precarity of my own subjective coherence, let's say, in that moment. I didn't have a great plan for what to do exactly. And I was also in between things. I had to leave early because plans didn't come together in quite the way that I had expected them to with my wife, and our daughter had a play date, and one of us had to get her there. There were various other things going on. And so part of that became an occasion, I think, for reflecting on and enacting the ideas that Aaron was writing about in this text that we were studying, this being in the act. Because I think being in the act means kind of finding yourself in the context of your life and your life situation as it is unfolding. And in that act, or in that moment, doing philosophy, like coming up with something that you can build upon. I don't think I had a huge investment in the specific exercise that I was imagining. I think that what it became was a catalyst, or became a kind of it became a almost a disturbance or something, like, to the field in a way that provoked something, that made something happen. But that wasn't my intention, because if we had done the exercise, then you know, something else would have happened, and my apparent or my perceived intention would have been fulfilled. So for me, it was a learning experience in that I felt that in the moment I had to very quickly let go of whatever it is that I wanted to do and pay attention to what it was that was actually arising as a result of my coming into the space with this kind of turbulent thrown energy, this kind of incoherence. We had to sort of constellate some coherence around the incoherence. And then I think out of that, various other things emerged, including your story, Jeffrey, and then, you know, other threads of conversation. But I think that that's part of what I resonate with in Aaron in this notion is a recognition that we don't have a perfect starting place. We can't retreat to the, you know, initial conditions that would allow us to come up with the perfect, the most composed, the most thought through process, procedure, method, what have you. We have to improvise. We have no choice but to improvise. Even our supposed plans are improvisations ultimately, you know. But the more we think them through, I think, and the more we rehearse them, they can become, I think we can become more comfortable in them. They don't have to feel so chaotic. So coming to those patterns, you know, that work and that we can build upon, I think that would be a good result from these experiments.
I think as well, this sort of harkens back to some of the things I've talked about in previous sessions about this feeling of moving away from the center and moving more towards the periphery in a place where I can watch and listen and be affected in a different way than sort of finding myself, as I said, a sort of center stage. And what's been really interesting about this group, and it goes back to what you were talking about, Jeffrey, and these responses, is that we have this group of people as the sort of main relationship developing. But I just wanted to comment on the importance of the minor relationships. And when I say minor, I don't mean in significance, because they're actually extremely important. But my relationship with Jeffrey, so you were saying, Jeffrey, like sometimes it feels uncomfortable coming into a group of people that you don't know, but is what's interesting is that you invited me into this group, and I, because of my relationship with you and the deep connection we have, it's been interesting to see how that has unfolded or changed or trickled through. Pat coming into this as well too, our relationships were very different 5-7 years ago because they were arranged in a very structural way where I was the student and these were my mentors. So it's been interesting to feel and sense and watch how that has changed within this group, but it's also very interesting for me to watch how your relationships have changed as well too, because Doug, Marco, and John, I'm not sure how long you've known one another and how your relationships have evolved, but even this event, if you want to call it, that happened a couple of weeks ago, it's just really interesting for me to sit back and watch how your relationships are changing as well within the group, and how important and how that relates to a kind of minor gesture in itself, because as those relationships change, the whole group changes and you become part of it. And to use the overused rhizomatic term again, it does become rhizomatic. And then I feel like I get to know you a little bit better, John, and you, Doug, and you, Marco, as well, and just because of these exchanges and changes. So I just wanted to comment on the importance of the minor tide that's going on below all of this as well too, and how that's shifting what this group has become. And I want to say thank you to all of you as well too for giving me the opportunity just to be part of that and to witness that and sense that in a different way, because it's helped change my thinking even in the environment that I go to every day. It really changes your sensibility and makes you notice things in a different way. So thank you for that.
Going off of that, for whatever reason, I'm thinking about 20 years into the future and imagining Aaron writing another book that we're discussing. It'll be called like The Minor Cosmos or something, how we bring about the minor gesture into the world. But maybe you can think about that when I stumble upon my words here. I'm trying to stick with what Jeffrey was talking about and this Zoom space we're talking about, how it differs from other modes. And I feel like we've discussed this in various other conversations or even outside of our conversations here. And the reason I missed last week was because of a confrontation through email with another supervisor for the state. We're a contractor for the state. And the entire time I'm sitting here thinking, well, if we could just meet face to face or even have a Zoom conference, all this would be solved. It was my words were actually out of love, and it was mistaken as snarky or sarcastic. And I was just coming off of having a child. So I was in that zone, in that mode or field. I'm still going through that mess, and eventually we'll have a meeting face to face and we'll realize that we're all great people and that we can be on the same page. That's going to happen in 2 weeks. So I'm looking forward to that part of it, but it's very similar to some of the forum conversations here or anywhere you experience without the video, without the face to face, even what we're doing here. You can, it tends towards misunderstandings and rude comments, or if even if it's nice comments, it's going to be comments that you'll say, well, great, I love you too, and then it'll stop there. But the negative comments will always expound upon themselves, that it seems there's no resolution just because we don't have that connection to some sort of understanding of each other. And I think it comes back to that, those minor gestures, to the micro processes. But I forgot what I was wanting to say.
Well, just to pick up quick then on that, Doug, mm-hmm. there is a, in my experience, a big difference between having met somebody face to face and having met them online virtually. And like you and I, we haven't met face to face. Jeffrey and I haven't, and Coralie, we haven't met face to face. I've met John face to face. We've been in the same physical.
More than once, actually.
Yes, more than once. Various other people, and there's different, you know, configurations of that, right? Like John has met Caroline face to face, for example. Even though Caroline,
I've met your wife and your daughters.
Yeah, indeed.
I know the family.
I feel that you're all real. Like Jeffrey, you're real. Coralie, you're real. Douglas, you're real to me. But there's something that gets anchored too, even if it only happens once, when people's physical bodies come in the same, you know, environment, in the same field. And so I think that the Zoom adds other layers of information, let's just to put it crudely, to what we would get from text. Text, on the other hand, allows for more reflection, if assuming one takes the time to reflect before one writes, and to compose one's words and one's thoughts in a way that in the moment here when we're speaking, I think is harder to do. And you know, I know that if I go back, I feel that I've incompletely expressed myself most of the time, which is why I have to keep writing. Or we have to keep doing these talks. I think that, you know, there are other layers to this as well. I mean, there's the actual political layer, by which I mean institutions, laws, like the political entities that we're dealing with. There's also the economic layer. And you know, just touch on that. When Erin was here, the very first session, she mentioned a technology that she was interested in, or that SenseLab was working with, called Holochain. And Holochain is a kind of decentralized computing interface, but it's meant to, and it's intended to allow technological relationships between people that are not mediated by central authorities, like a governmental authority or a corporate authority. So we also have to take into account that all of our virtual interactions are mediated by powerful central authorities. And we happen to use these consumer products like Zoom, but the infrastructure that allows us to even have these communications, unlike in physical space where it's just the air that's between, it's purely the commons that is between us when we meet face to face. When we meet virtually, we're doing so in a territory that's already structured by those economic and political forces. So also having different technologies or developing decentralized technologies that allow us to communicate without that kind of mediation or through our own mediation is important. And I attended one night of a hackathon around for Holochain, and learned a little bit more about how that architecture works. And I'm not, you know, a computer scientist or you know, all that capable of speaking intelligently about the technology, but I think it's very promising. And I think that if there are entities like SenseLab and like Cosmos and like others that are not only developing their own discourses, narratives, group subjects, but are also then interfacing with each other through and developing their own technologies, actually, that can go around the predominant ones now, that begins to look to me more like the emergence of a different kind of society. And you know, that we'd have to also integrate with food systems and all other kinds of systems. But if we, my sense of where to go with this is to find, to create other means and avenues of communication and of exchange on all those levels, on the cultural level, the economic level, the political level, et cetera, that can occur on our own terms, on the terms that we would define autonomously and locally and in these meshworks with each other.
If I might, I'm not sure if it's a segue or follow up what you said is kind of maybe slightly tangential line of, so I'm sort of interested in this question about the video Zoom environment versus other mediated exchanges. So we all have stories of these things. I mean, in a modern world, in the modern world that we live in, we've had a series of encounters, many of them, I'm guessing, I mean, some are positive, but many of them are negative. And these structure or inform how we engage with each other in these online environments, right? So I'm thinking, for instance, just as an example, of a minor gesture, that a minor gesture kind of exchange that I experienced, which was extremely negative, because we've talked about the minor gesture as more in a kind of positive spin. But there's nothing to stop minor gestures having a negative effect and not just a positive effect. So this was an encounter with a colleague in my department who was in charge of heading the committee of graduate students in the department. The person who sort of approved which students got accepted into the department in order to be supervised and how the supervision was managed over time by this committee. And he was a colleague that I didn't dislike, but I didn't particularly like, but we got along reasonably okay. But he had a kind of choleric kind of disposition, which I probably should have paid more attention to. And he did some things as head of this committee that I thought were pejorative to one of my students. So I wrote an email complaining, sort of suggesting that maybe this wasn't the best thing to do. And he took it as a personal attack. And he never spoke to me for the next 20 years after that exchange of emails. I tried to go and speak to him, to apologize, to, you know, say, can we just put this aside? And he worked in the next office over from mine. I mean, we were literally neighbors in the corridor. But he never said a word. My wife died. He never said a word to me about that whole trauma that I went through. Nothing. He retired, and he still had never said a word to me. So there's an example of a minor gesture in the email context. I mean, we literally saw each other every day face to face. So it was just and you know, with catastrophic results. So, you know, that's one of the experiences that I have in my past that affects how I deal with other people online. So I'm very careful what I say in emails. And then I had and then there are other sort of maybe more standard kinds of things like, so I'm single and you know, I have questions about dating. And so I tried a few online dating things, you know, so, and there was one particular occasion where it was through an online dating thing. And I had started this email conversation, you know, this sort of text chat with this woman. And we got on like houses on fire. It was just this fantastic exchange. And it was very, very interesting. And so we set up a meeting. And it was a total disaster.
I think that's universal experience there.
She wasn't at all. She wasn't at all in person, the person I thought that I'd, you know, so, I mean, I know that's a kind of a classic online experience, and it's the text versus the actual in person. Whereas here we're on video. Video is a different mediation than text, as we're saying. And I, for me, the jury's still out on how close the video chat experience is to the real life. I don't know. I don't have enough experience compared because I have never met you guys in real life. So I, you know, maybe it would be a disaster too. I don't know. I mean, we do video chats in the work environment. So there, for instance, there's a team in France that we've been working in over the last year. And it's been through video chat, you know, seminars, and we hear each other talk over the video conference and sort of talk back and forth to each other. And then this summer I met them because they came over for a conference here, and it was fantastic. You know, it was really nice to actually meet them in person. So my experiences have been rather positive with the meeting people that you've met through video chat originally, but. You know, I'm still a bit curious, what is the difference between the two? And so it comes back to this question of, because in a way, video chat is all about minor gestures. Yeah, I mean,
it is,
yeah. It's, you know, the things that really matter in our lives are the things that we encounter every day as we walk around and do our things. I mean, there's lots of minor gestures in there, but there are lots of major gestures. But the video chat tends to be in the minor key for me somehow. It's peripheral to my life in a way. I mean, it's central in importance, but it's peripheral in the structure of my life. I'm not sure what I'm saying, but that's what.
I have a personal example that kind of ties together, at least my initial question of, and it related to Johnny's question too, and somewhat everybody else's question of how do we bring this minor gesture feeling that we've gotten here out into the real world? We've brought that up maybe in past sessions, not necessarily just a minute ago, but a couple of years ago, I was writing pretty deep letters to my mother, which she was very receptive to, just as an attempt to gather up my collective thoughts and anxieties of our past and bring that to the front without, which I had trouble with face-to-face talk. Nora could, she lives in a state below me in Tennessee. I live in Kentucky, and we often do FaceTime or Skype conversations. And the chance for that type of deep talk, it comes up a little bit more than maybe in the person-to-person, just because we have such limited time together. We don't have that chance to, or at least I don't have the courage to pull her aside and say, let's have this hour or 2 hour conversation. But in the letters, I'm able to, maybe just like a forum, you can think before you write down or before you speak. So there was a depth of that relationship, that unspoken relationship. And now when I see her, we had maybe one deep conversation based on the letter exchange. Kind of saying, okay, we're on the same page. I understand the dumb stuff you did when you were a kid and why you couldn't express it to me, type of thing. So we're on more of the same level, but there's still all those other minor details of, well, I can't really get along with her because of political views or personal holdups, whatever it might be. So to meet in person, again, I don't know where I'm going with this, but but the this Zoom space opens up the field in ways, like Marco was saying, that there's all these different levels, there's all these different layers. I can put myself on mute and scream at the top of my lungs if I want to, which is something I couldn't do in a conversation face to face. Or if I did, I would be questioned and maybe not have a second meeting with that person. But there's something special about this space that I feel maybe what Marco was hinting at, as we get more and more towards a version of online experience that coincides with the ecological bringing about unity, to where we have a technology that supports our beliefs as well as supports our own personal psychology or personal holdups, anxieties. Once we have that, which this is the branching out into that space, but I feel it taps into the field a little bit more than even a personal encounter can. So I'll stop there. And again, going back to my question, or our question, of how do we bring this back out into the real world? How do I, if I ever meet up with one of you in person, how do I carry this feeling into our face-to-face conversation?
Well, the virtual is real, right? I mean, we can't say that the virtual is not the real world. And, you know, I think that...
It's almost a parallel universe in a way.
But is it, it's real, but it's not actual.
That's right.
I tune in more or less two or three times a week to what's happening on this site, and each group has a different kind of affective tone. But I'm tuning into a little square with a face in it and an environment behind them. And when this call is over, the affects that have resonated can still be operating. I can still be resonating with that for days. And, you know, if the exchanges are creative and generative, it's great. If they're not, it can be awful. And I think this is something that we're all sort of experiencing with this technology, the intrusive aspect of it, and the part of it that's very creative. In a way, I'm tuning into the walls and the books and the pictures on the walls that are in your environment. That's real, but it's not actual. So it's curious about this interplay of these affective zones and what can trigger a negative experience that we can learn from and a negative experience that we cannot learn from, which is what I will call trauma. And sometimes we're traumatized by this technology, and sometimes we are re-traumatized by this technology. And I think that's when we need to know what's the difference between a negative experience that can be learned from, and are we re-traumatizing one another? And that's what brought up, that came up for me, that comes up for me constantly when I use the social media, and why I've had to withdraw into solitude on more than one occasion to just get clearer about what's mine and what's not mine. Other people's disasters, you know, have nothing to do with me or nothing I can do anything about, but I can still register the affects of that. And I wonder how collectively useful that could be. It could be very unuseful, especially as we look at the political landscape that's emerging out of this, the use of this tweets and Facebook and all this stuff. Anyway, I'm just reminded, as you were talking, Douglas, and the contrast and compare of writing a text, a letter, and something intimate with your mother, or face-to-face, and how face-to-face sometimes inhibits that intimacy, that intimate zone, whereas a letter can actually carry that feeling. And I'm thinking about Proust when he, that famous scene where he takes the Madeleine, and it's a little cake, and he dips it in tea, and he tastes it, and all of a sudden, the village of Cambrai, I think it was Cambrai, where he grew up, the entire village comes into his awareness. That whole relational field with his grandmother and the maid and all the people who he interacted with. And I'm just, I think that's such a charming incident in literature, and it's quoted over and over again, about how something can trigger us. Something as simple as a cup of tea and a little bit of cake can trigger a whole world, a virtual world. And I think that's, you know, what are we triggering in our episodes here and other episodes in the social media? So it's important for me that we're triggering something that's going to be useful rather than, and create coherence, greater coherence, rather than decoherence. And I think it's how we use the technology. The technology is pretty neutral in many ways, but how are we going to use it that's going to determine that? So I'm very appreciative of Marco's exploring Holochain, these different kinds of platforms, and how we can actually close down and be independent of other systems. And that would be a new innovation. But I think there's that optimal is open closure, you know, so that can we be open and closed at the same time? I think that's important, so that we don't end up being, we don't end up becoming totalitarian. And more totalitarian factions starting to implode, moving us further and further from anything ecological. So are we moving towards that ecological civilization, or are we moving away from it? I think those are the kind of questions that keep me up at night. Anyway, thank you very much for this, once again, this opportunity to go to the edge a little bit of our maps and carry the question across.
Interesting you talk about trauma, John. So I spent a year, more or less, in this, actively engaged in this online environment called Second Life. You probably know a little bit about it, but no, it's a virtual world where you have an avatar and you're moving around in a world, and it's lots of other avatars and buildings and all sorts of things. And I made some friends on through it, and some of them, I don't think I've got any that are still friends, but it was a corporate mediated environment. So it was one of the things I discovered that with a lot of these environments that you're so dependent on the corporation that runs them to maintain your friendships that you form through these things. So it's one of the reasons why I'm sort of more interested in this kind of site where there's no corporate entity that mediates directly, because you know, you make friends and then you lose them because the corporation changed the policy or something and it doesn't work anymore. But on this Second Life experience, they had a number of, so there was at one point 10 million people involved in this thing. So it was a lot of people, and they had thousands of different environments, and they ran games on, like, games within the Second Life environment sort of thing. And so they had a number of these. I was very, you know, I was just sort of interested in these environments. So they had about, I think, 15 different versions of gore role play. So I don't know if you've ever read the gore books. They're very machistic science fiction that was written many years ago. They're sort of borderline domination, submissive kind of stuff. And but I was intrigued by these environments. So I signed on to one of these things, and I went into this sort of gaming environment where you went through. And while I was wandering around in this environment, I fell off the sort of main protected area into the open-ended game, which was, in quotes, unprotected, which meant that anything could happen to you. And I got captured by a group of people, avatars, whatever. And they said, well, they wanted to rape me. And would I approve? Would I accept it? And the problem I had with this is I was raped in the past. And so it brought the whole thing up. So it's this re-traumatization that you're talking about, Johnny. And so I cut off the contact with Second Life, and I never went back. It was the end of my experience with Second Life, because it brought so much trauma back up to the surface that I couldn't even think about it for 6 months or a year before I started to even. So there's an example of an online experience that was another catastrophic one. Even though there were lots of positive things about my Second Life experience, the fashion design that I do came out of that experience, because what I did in the Second Life is I started to design fashions, because there was a big fashion sort of component to it. So I started to design fashions on Second Life first in the virtual environment. And then I thought to myself, oh, I could do this in real life. And so I moved over and started, that's when I started developing my fashion design stuff. So lots of positive things came out of the Second Life experience, but that one negative thing stalled me for a number of years before I could digest and work forward with it. So yeah, these environments can be very dangerous too.
Thanks for bringing that up. I remember watching a documentary on Second Life, and people were actually making a living designing clothing or whatever for the avatars, and it's very interesting. And thanks for sharing your experience there as well. I just, my more utopian mindset would say, well, virtual reality will be a safe place where there won't be any trauma, but then there's also the real life, or the actual versus the virtual. And so your sharing of the experience there really opened up quite a bit of possibilities or holdups of what our technology can bring. So
I also want to bring attention to, I don't know exactly how to put this in words, but you just articulated your experience of trauma without re-traumatizing yourself or triggering any trauma among us. This is my imagination. I mean, someone may have been triggered in ways that is not obvious, but I could feel the affect of it was not reactivating a traumatic episode. But this is, maybe you've gone through the process of reclaiming your power in refusing to comply with this demand of this group. And I believe that's I think you've turned a trauma that you couldn't learn from. I think that's my definition of trauma. It's a negative experience you can't learn anything from. And turning it into something that you have learned something from, and that you can share, it then becomes registered in this affective zone of this group. And I believe that can mature all of us, so that we just don't live in a Pollyanna world where we can just dream up anything we want and get people to agree. It doesn't work that way. These traumas are deep in us, and sometimes the traumas didn't happen to us, but happened to our parents or our parents' parents. And it gets it gets transferred. So I think that's a great opportunity for us if we have that maturity, that we've explored the our micro perceptual aspects of our nature, and we can attune to that subtle, those subtle, very subtle ranges, these affective zones, rather than just creating primary emotions again that we couldn't handle then, and we don't need to redo it. That's why I'm very aware of exploring a stuck state, and you have a desired outcome over here. This is what I want to have happen. And there are all effects that will come out of having this. And then there's this primary stuck state. And how do we go from this stuck state to this desired outcome? Now, for me, this desired outcome is a new problem. It's not free of constraints, but it's a different problem, the desired outcome, than the stuck state. And that's why we were juxtaposing these possibilities in this interview, in this, what happened, I think, when Marco was bringing forward this this disability. He wanted us to explore this disability. And I sort of went, I don't think so, because that disability is fraught with peril for me. I was disempowered in ways that have never come back. And I'm not going to go there, because I will just be a puddle, which I don't think Marco's interested in initiating that. I don't think he wanted to do that at all. But I think this disability for him is something that he, a stuck state that could be very, very possibly very generative. And but for me, it wouldn't be a negative to learn from. It would be a negative that would destroy me. And I don't want to go that way. So I think we need to be aware of the requests that we make of one another. Could be just a minor gesture for us, but could be for another person, a black hole. And I think, I hope I'm exploring this affective zone with the group, not in order to create more trauma, but to actually release the trauma from our collective experience so that we can learn from it and move on in maybe more desired outcome direction. But I also realize just having desired outcomes can be problematic as well if we're not returning sometimes to the cause of this stuck state. But I think that our tendency culturally is to get caught in the stuck state. This is what psychoanalysis has taught us. Stay in the stuck state and we can explore that stuck state forever. And that desired outcome, I believe, might initiate something else that could create intensity. But if this desired outcome and this stuck state, if the desired outcome doesn't have more intensity than this stuck state, the system cannot tip. And the stuck state will remain an attractor that will continue to attract, perhaps for generations to come. So I think this is very big stuff that we're embarking on. How are we going to move towards an ecological civilization with the multiple pasts that we can draw upon? And some of them are really pretty disastrous. So I think we have to be ever mindful of these dynamics and what is it, in what direction do we want to create intensity?
No, I don't think I fully understood what the trigger was. There were some pieces I was trying to put together. I don't think I had a clear articulation of exactly what I was attempting to do or going for. In retrospect, I can reconstruct some of it. Could you help with that?
I think you said you want to go into, you wanted to explore that disability. Mm-hmm. I think Aaron was talking a lot about autism and autistic perception and disability, and that you've often felt in the context of your work as a writer,
yeah,
a disability.
Yeah.
And you wanted to explore that disability, and you had a sort of procedure that you sort of hadn't, you've never done this before, so it was an experiment, and you wanted to, you wanted everyone to sort of get into the disability, make a movement that reflected that disability, and then to type a message to one another.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even, when you said disability, go into the disability, I was like, I can't even talk, much less make a movement or type anything. And that's part of my arrested development. There were things where, at very young, I was slapped and they beat the shit out of me. And I just thought, okay, I'll learn how to shut down. And as I've matured and gotten older, I realized I shut down. And that was quite a reasonable thing to do at a young age. But now I have to sort of re-embody after that. And I think these triggers are so subtle. Sometimes I could have maybe performed adequately and just pretended it didn't hurt. And I could have done something that would have been adequate to sort of, you know, please the group. But I think, and I think I was pointing out, I think that could just be a reprise of the factory model education we're all trying to go beyond. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you intended to trigger any kind of traumatic episode. I think this, the difference once again between a negative we can learn from and have learned from and a negative we can't learn from. And to know the difference, mm-hmm, is very tricky in these online forums, because we could be unintentionally triggering one another. And I think I'm easily triggered by other people, and I don't let them know it. If I do the risky thing, I'll say, hey, I've been triggered. It's not your fault. It's not what you intended. But this is the result of your communication. And how can we work with that? Mm-hmm. In a way that's creative rather than turns into a cat fight.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I intended, to ask people to get in touch with a disability per se. Part of the...
Yeah, I didn't hear you correctly. I may not have heard you correctly.
Well, I think part of the tricky piece of the text, too, was that Aaron is drawing connections between an autistic in the real sense, the actual sense of that term, mode of perception, mode of communication, the Audi type, for example, and an artistic mode, which has similar qualities in that reality is not pre-chunked, it's not pre-packaged. There's a freshness of perception. There's a nakedness of contact with being. I don't know how to awkward way of putting it, but I think I was maybe playing with that or relating to that in the sense that I, as a writer, part of, I think, the reason I'm a writer is that I have disability, quote unquote, with communication.
That makes sense.
It does, oddly.
Yeah. I write for the same reason. You know?
I was in my way trying to find a way to relate to, well, it's not the same as autistic perception, but particularly when I saw the documentary, Wretches and Jabberers, and the how much work it took to facilitate a simple communication from one human being to another, it seemed like so poignant. It seemed like such an apt metaphor for perhaps what we might be doing in our collective contexts around trying to say something that is beyond what is being said around us. So the neoliberal narrative, for example, or, you know, the kind of insidious Facebook kind of speak or way of subjectifying ourselves, way of being subjects. How do we find other modes of speaking and communicating? And there's a difficulty in that, in there. If, again, not to complete the two, but I think there's, you know, there's a great need for facilitation because we're so disabled in socially or intersubjectively, politically. And I think though I hear what you're saying in that the stuckness, I think making the distinction between the stuck state and the desired outcome is very clarifying for me, because I could see how fixating on the stuckness can perpetuate the stuckness and can blind us to what we actually would want, what would actually move us beyond it. And saying that's partly, you know, what I like about the In the Act is that you have to go with something, right? You can't just stay stuck. You have to try something. You have to move to get out of it. And so I've been encouraged by the text and certainly by these conversations that we've had here and in other threads to keep moving. 'Cause my tendency, my particular trauma my sort of mode of staying stuck is to shut down. So, to not talk, you know, to overthink, you know, to conceptualize when I could be expressing more. And that's part of, you know, if I have a motive perhaps for, you know, initiating things like this, it's to move out of that stuckness, but that doesn't mean that there isn't still a kind of gravity there or a center of gravity that I can get pulled into and potentially pull others into. So it's been a useful exchange.
Well, I think you're bringing attention to the pre-individual rather than the subject. And that's been my challenge, is to realize that a lot of the trauma that I experienced, and I experienced a lot of it, especially social trauma, it happened in groups. And there were some private things that were traumatic as well, but I realized that's not me. That's not the subject. Because we can walk around after we've done 20, 30 years of psychoanalysis and that kind of therapy, basically staying in the stuck state, re-traumatizing the person perpetually. They can then become identified with the trauma. I am trauma. And I think that's where we have to realize that the pre-individual and the trans-individual are shapeshifters in this vast field, this vast relational field that can inhabit these traumatic episodes and then exit while maintaining enough metastability in the system so that it doesn't decohere. And I think we can, as individuals, probably have mastered enough of these dynamics, but then we come into groups and we realize we have to do it on another entirely different level, come much more sophisticated than just my micro-perceptual exploration, because we're dealing with macro dynamics when we're entering into groups, into even larger groups, into groups that the members of whom I will never meet, but yet I'm affiliated with. So I think this is when we're moving from a self-organizing system, here's a stuck state, there's a desired outcome, and a something that's involving a group. So what do we want to have happen? And what happens next when we know what we want to have happen? And since we are nowhere near able to articulate a coherent we, They want something. I think we're going to get the Donald Trumps and the Adolf Hitlers and the Margaret Thatchers and the people who are running the world right now. So this is my personal calling, is how can we create a we space that can become more coherent rather than just reproduce the family dynamics that traumatized myself and so many of us, and that we're indoctrinated, enculturated through the factory model educations that we're still imposing. So that's a tall order. But I think these little micro, these sort of minor gestures that we're inviting the group to open up to can be catalyzing, as you have mentioned, Marco. I think this, and we can make lots of mistakes, but let's make safe to fail mistakes. And I think we talked about that once much earlier, that we need safe to fail experiments. But I don't think we should go into experiments where if we fail, we fuck up big time. I think we've had enough of, what is that place in Japan, Fukushima and Chernobyl, you know? I think we know enough about those big, colossal bloopers that we should avoid as much as possible.
I appreciate, John, your insistence on this pre-individual and the trans-individual and the relationship with the subject, because if I come back to my own trauma that I shared earlier, so I thought about it before I said anything, because it is a sensitive issue for me. And you're right, I have worked through it a great deal, but like you, the working through wasn't so much, although there was some of that, staying present for the trauma and working through in the stuck state. But it also had to do with moving to a different space. So because, you know, as you say, you can't do that. In fact, the pain is so huge, you cannot stay present for it indefinitely, because it hurts too much. So you have to move to a different space. And over time, I've learned to do that. And so I can talk about it. And I do talk about it in shared contexts, because I know it's useful to share those things. And it other people learn from my sharing those things. So, you know, I've learned to overcome my own reticence to talk about them enough to be able to share them. But that doesn't mean to say there isn't any pain underneath, or, you know, that I couldn't still go there and feel the, what feels like infinite pain if you actually go there. So.
And as Zeran would say, you're more than, there's yeah. That pain, and it could be immobilizing pain, but you're also always much more than the pain that you've suffered. And I just want to hold that much more possibility, so that we can reorganize not just the self as the subject, but open up to the field.
And Aaron,
that's where we're going to be healed at a much deeper level, I think.
And Aaron's been through trauma, so it's clear it's underneath her writing is her own traumatic incidents. I'm not sure what they are exactly, but I know that she's had quite a lot of trauma in her youth. So thank you for coming back on that point. It's an important thing, I think.
Anyone see the video that Heather shared on the last topic? Last week's topic.
Videos? Is that like a band YouTube talk or side?
No, it was a
the Black Lives Matters one.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was called Accidental Courtesy.
Oh yes, the between the three gentlemen. The black different activists working together.
Right. So Tariq Touré, Kwame Rose, one's a poet, another is a an activist in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. In the Baltimore area, and the video picks up as they're you know, as they're protesting, I think it was Freddie Gray's killing. But they're talking with a fellow named Daryl Davis, and I didn't get the whole story. I watched this prior to our call, but Davis has a project where he infiltrates the Ku Klux Klan and collects their robes, and is attempting to interface with them in some way. Is attempting to, he implies in this talk with the other two, transform the relationship in some way. He claims to have, through his activities, exposed or eliminated the Klan in Maryland. That turns out to be contested later in the video. But it was a really interesting argument. I think, it's a step removed from our context here, but it reflects it in that, here's a person who is going deeply into a historical trauma and triggering a very intense response from the other two. And they're making an argument to him that all the time and energy that he spent, and I think it's, many years, 16 years or something, working with these Klansmen could have been better spent with building up the community, building up the power of the people that are most suffering, most directly suffering from that dynamic, from that history. I thought it was interesting because they really took oppositional sides to it. There wasn't a resolution in the video clip. We get to hear at the end of it, Daryl Davis claiming that the other two believed that these white people, these Klansmen, were unchangeable, that they were going to be completely stuck in their views, and therefore what he was doing was pointless. And I don't know if they would agree with having made that claim. But I thought it presented an interesting, it was inconclusive, and I thought it presented an interesting perspective, because one could argue that Davis was doing something that may not obviously support the community, but has some kind of weird ecological role in symbolically undoing this ideology of white supremacy or something like that. And one could also argue, I think, that the notion that even a diehard white supremacist or Klansman couldn't change is a limiting kind of belief. On the other hand, the argument that to focus on one's own empowerment is a very much more effective, and much more appreciated stance to take, I think is very strong. And I think the connection, here is what empowers a community, what empowers a group to move toward a desired end, move toward a common goal. And how do you draw the boundaries around that? How do you say that, these actions are leading towards that desired goal, this action over here is not? I don't have a conclusion about that, but I thought it illustrated some of the dilemma that we could be facing, because sometimes very controversial, unconventional means could, in a non-linear way, be serving a common goal, even if that common goal isn't commonly articulated from the outset.
That's a great episode to bring forward, because I think that the three men, I think there was a fourth man who joins the call after the two of the men leave. But there seems to be a consensus that all three of the men were in opposition to the approach taken by Davis, I believe his name is. And one of and they were younger. Mm-hmm. They were younger men, and he was a much older man. And something that one of the younger men said to him was, so you're going to open this museum with all these Ku Klux Klan robes, and do you think I'm going to take my daughter to see that? Have you ever heard of intergenerational trauma? He asked the man. Mm-hmm. And I felt this very, for me, affectively, it was very charged. Because I think they were condemning his approach, but I also think they were missing out on the history of the trauma. And maybe for good reasons. I mean, and I understand why he wouldn't want to bring his daughter to hear about this, the Ku Klux Klan and how they lynched all these horrible injustices that they were committed. And so I think it's like those traumas, if they're not turned into negative events that we can learn from, they can get passed on in very devious ways, not through what is said, but through what is not said. Most of these intergenerational traumas get passed on because the person that was traumatized said nothing about it. I had and this is where I think cultural hypnosis, cultural trance, is such an interesting field of study. Because I remember, this was an experience. I've had lots of these episodes doing age regression. People will remember things. But one particular one I thought was very moving, because this woman, I don't know what her presenting problem was, but the therapist, sorry about the dogs, they're barking again, the dogs of wrath, just let those sounds pass right through you. But there was this woman who, she in a trance state went back into her childhood and couldn't find anything traumatic happen. But the therapist said, keep going back until you find it. And then she remembered her mother. She remembered as her mother an experience of being raped as a young person by a family, not a family member, but a friend of her father. And this man who raped her told her if she said anything, he would kill her father. And she never said anything. Anyway, this young woman came out of the trance and initiated a conversation with her mother. And her mother corroborated that report and said, that's right. And that happened, and I never have said anything to anybody. So it's amazing how this young woman had carried that feeling across from her mother into her own physiology and her own subtle field, her connection to the field. And some of the things that were being blocked in her own communications with others did not originate from her own experience, but was a field effect from something that happened to her mother and perhaps her mother's mother. So I thought that was a very poignantly brought forward by this trialogue or quartet between these black men who shared a trauma, very deep one, and it's an ongoing, the effects of which are ongoing. But how do you deal with that? It is inconclusive for all of us.
Well, how universal is trauma? I mean, does anybody not have either personal trauma or pre-personal field trauma?
Pre-personal field trauma. I like that. Yeah.
It's like the studies I've been doing of the effects of the Second World War on people's lives. So people don't talk about it. People they live their lives and they never talk about it. But when you ask people, if you try, you can try the experiment. You can ask several people in your entourage whether or not people have either family members or friends of the family members or somebody who was affected by the Second World War. And I guarantee you that 9 times out of 10, there will be stories that emerge that are traumatic from these people's lives. They're just not discussed, but they're there. And so, is, you know, the Second World War had a huge impact on the world that's barely talked about anymore. And yet it's all there underneath, you know, still. So.
It seems like humanity has massive processing to do. We talked about this briefly before, Jeffrey, but my father grew up in Italy during the Second World War. He was just a kid when German forces came into his town. So that, he's talked about that with me a few times, written a little bit about it, but only recently, not when I was growing up. That was the unsaid, I think, one aspect of the unsaid. My mother, other side. So this intergenerational, I feel that part of my own work, part of the work of my own lifetime is to uncover some of that. Of course, that's just one drop in the ocean. But as I become aware of it, and as I've gotten older, I've realized how deeply it's affected me, how this sense, this feeling within myself that there's something deep and dark and terrible is true. It really is. But it wasn't personal. It didn't happen in my life. But it's still there. It still manifests within my life. And so gaining clarity, like that historical perspective, I think is really important. And it does come through in stories. It comes through in piecing together, connecting the dots between things my father might have said, an uncle, what I know from the history books or from documentaries, etc. And then, of course, taking the bigger perspective and seeing even not just that war as one episode in a much larger kind of, trauma associated with human emergence and human, the human experiment. That takes it to another, I think, zone. But anyway, I think it's just provides endless, an endless source for working on something. Again, I don't think it's a good idea to get stuck there. I think having a vision for the future that is universal in a certain sense. Like, I think we have to imagine what kind of planet we want to live on, because these traumas are planetary ultimately, right? At that, and I think ultimately, just to use a loaded word, we have to live on this planet. So we have to process the traumas of history. And I think probably the portal into them has to go through the personal. It has to go through the first person, into the pre-personal, and through perhaps that circle, we could bring it into a trans-personal or trans-individual planetary level. That's kind of speculating, but I'm just seeing what the shapes of this, are, how the microcosm can link into the macrocosm.
I absolutely agree, but I think we need to talk about these things. I mean, there's this notion of the white shadow, which is related to what we're talking to. It's a psychoanalytic term, but it's this idea of the intergenerational influence of trauma on the next generation, even though the generation before has never actually talked about the things. The next generation picks up, as Johnny was saying, picks up, even if it's never discussed, picks up the trauma and incorporates it into the person's body, even though they have no direct knowledge of what happened. And this is called the white shadow. And, it's rife throughout our planetary societies. And as I say, just starting to talk to people about it, you know, stories come out and they need to be, we need to be talking about these things. We should be looking at, you know, World War II related trauma as a civilization, because it's clearly has a huge influence on what's going on, but nobody's talking openly about it. For years, of course, it was kind of taboo. You know, the people didn't want to talk about it, but now we're at a point where we kind of need to, you know. So.
And we could talk about it, and we can write fiction, poems, and dance.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know who the poet was, that the antidotes to suffering is beauty. And I just wanted to quote one more thing from Immediation that I think is relevant here. About the pre-individual. When the pre-individual is mistaken for interiority, I think that means his subject. When the pre-individual is mistaken for the subject, the pre-individual could be traumas endured by your species or other species. But when that is mistaken for the subject, the resulting subject feels that it should be able to hold all the potential of the field in itself. This is impossible because, as we were saying, the potential is irreducibly relational. It can only be held integrally in situations. It can't be accessed just by individual choice or decision, but only by events in which others are also implicated. The imperative that the individual is often made to feel to live up to its own potential, mistaking the world's potential for a being in itself, creates an unlivable tension. It actually bottles the potential up. And I feel that, I've often felt, and I'm sure others have too, that I am attuning to a unlived or unfelt potential in this group. And it becomes an enormous burden. It makes me want to be alone, please. Because I just, this unfulfilled, unexpressed potential, it's masked by all the chit-chat and the superficial conceptualizing and that we're all prone to. And it feels like, and that sort of undercurrent of the unexpressed and the untouched and the unfelt, and though that which has not been paid attention to. The ghosts, you know, the hungry ghosts that have not been acknowledged. I think we, you know, I think writers and poets and dancers are probably more attuned to that, to those hungry ghosts, and they wanna give it some kind of form so that then it can be released.
We're coming up to 2 hours here. I know, Cora, you've been sort of indicating you wanted to speak, and then you sit back again. Do you have something you would like to say before we? You're on mute. Sure.
I'm not sure how this will relate to right where we are in this conversation, but just earlier, the word movement comes out so much in these conversations, and I wanted to ask Marco a question from earlier when it's to do with the conversation of being moving from the unstuck to another place. And I was just curious on the day that you chose to walk around during these sessions, is two or three weeks ago and you were outside. Was that a conscious decision to do that? Was that a strategy of yours, sort of aligning with the conversation you had about, or that we've been having about that stuck place and where that moves to? Was that a strategy, or did you just decide to do that on that day?
The idea to do so arose out of reading the text, because I was sitting down and there was something explicitly about movement. And also that connected to something Doug had shared previously, maybe not in discussions on the minor gesture, maybe actually it was, maybe the first call or two, about how he reads. And it just led me to reflect, why do I always sit when I read? Why do I think I have to be perfectly still when I read? And then that led me to think about factory model education and how that's how I was trained. You sit at your desk, you read, you become very still, have a very passive, in a sense, active in attention, but passive in body relationship to the content of the text. So combined with, it was a beautiful day out, combined with a kind of aversion that I've developed to being in front of a computer screen. And that's also come through conversations that we previously had. I want to move. I want to be outside. I want to feel the air, the sunshine, the scents. I want to. So it really just came together in that way. And the text was kind of gave a conceptual excuse to get up and move around. Excuse is joking. I mean that it sort of prompted an enactment of the theoretical content in a practical like sense, like in the occasion.
As we talk about this virtual space and what this is like, that's been running through our conversation today as well too. So it was just an interesting shift to watch you as well to move, and I was sitting still watching you move, and sort of the potential of what we could possibly do with these spaces. Do we have to sit in front of a computer screen? I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know.
Well, yeah, exactly. I imagine too, as the technology evolves, that this is a fairly clunky setup that we have here. And if it were actually to get better, it would be a lot more seamless than it is. I think that would be my desire for a better technology, is that it would allow virtual and actual to be more seamless. That doesn't mean I want neural implants necessarily. Certainly not if they're like owned by, Google.
No, of course.
Open source neural implants, I might be okay with. We'll see.
I am so glad that you were able to post yesterday's conversation yesterday.
Yes.
I don't think you uploaded it. You just like gave us a link where we could look at it. For those people like myself who are obsessed with review, because I can't remember what I say. I have no idea what anyone, it's just, I feel an affective response, but I can't break it down into verbal units. But anyway, I'm just letting you know how important that is for the ongoing momentum and the affective zones that are created, because if it takes a week before it's available, I get in between, something really unpleasant happens to me. And I don't know what it is, but it's something like something didn't get completed. But having it posted or available, not necessarily posted, but available to those of us who want to watch it and those who weren't able to attend, I think can help us heal those wounds more quickly. Rather than linger in trauma zone.
I'm going to try at least to have the temporary links up immediately. Based
that
on
helps a lot.
Feedback in particular, yeah. because the way that my life, I do this event and I might have something to do right after it, and then one thing leads to another, and I don't circle back to it. And I do like to reflect a bit on the event before I post it and add some notes if I can. But ultimately, I would like the platform to do that automatically, so that nobody has to upload it, and also that groups can form themselves and schedule things, record things, post them without the need for an administrator necessarily. I think
so. We would be more co-composing techno, the techno side of things.
That would be my. I desire that for sure, and if only selfishly to free myself from, the task of having to download, upload, and do this whole rigmarole. But we just haven't developed it yet. But I totally think we can. It's just a matter of focusing on it and bringing together the tools.
The only thing I would volunteer to do that, except I'm just terrified that I might erase something unintentionally.
Understood. Right. I think we can design. Here's where I'd like to use the technology and get more just concrete about it. I think we can design a system where safeguards are in place against accidental erasure and good backups and so forth, and more of a workflow. I think maybe Holochain will help with this.
So does anybody have any last words? I have a last word, but I want to give other people a chance for a last word. Doug, do you have anything you want to say? Recap, final?
More of a personal recap, at least where I'm at right now. I mentioned I'm reading Simon Don, and this whole notion of the pre-individual, the individuation, individual, trans-individual, 500 other terms that come out of that really interests me, and it ties in with my own personal reflections based on, and I'm, at least my awareness is immediately drawn to the session, Johnny, that you had. Most of it, I think everybody was present for the clean language, I, me, myself, and Doug, or our name, among
you.
Other, you, and just this internal space that I've created. I'd like to know where Simon Don takes the pre-individual. For me, almost sounds like the ground of being, and then, so that's where I'm exploring right now. And for another personal takeaway from this is, I don't necessarily want to go around quoting Aaron Manning in The Minor Gesture, but I'm interested in how do, for example, I bring The Minor Gesture into my experience with my mother, with my colleagues, with everyone else. And how do I explain the concepts to someone who might not be so receptive, whether it's through actual verbal explanation of the terms, who for somebody that might understand the whole methodology or non-methodology, whatever it might be, to actually just becoming and expressing it and showing others the field through creative acts and movements. So that's my momentary takeaway. So I hope to carry this with me further. And I hope we all meet again.
Nicely said. So I had a last kind of comment, but I'm going to go to Tao Te Ching again for my last comment. So I've been reading. There's a preamble. I've been reading a bunch of stuff, including Gebser, because I'm planning to go to the conference in October. So I'm in the process of developing some ideas about what I'm going to say. Probably it's something about the a perspectival in the context of poetry and writing or something. And so as part of that reading, because the conference on Gebser is about Asian influence, the relationship between Asian influence and Gebser, and my discussion with Heather about these things, and we discussed a number of writers, including Henri Michaud, who's a French writer who writes kind of a field like poetry prose. It's kind of a mixture of poetry and prose. So I picked up one of his books, which is called Un Barbare en Asie, so a barbarian in Asia. So it's this Asian link that I said. And the opening quote in the beginning of the book, so I opened it this morning, and it's Gouvernez l'Empire comme vous cuirez un petit poisson, which is a direct excerpt from from the Tao Te Ching. And I'll give you Le Guin's version of that, which is rule a big country the way you cook a small fish. So it's Lao Tzu everywhere today. But I'll read you the rest of the quote. So rule a big country the way you cook a small fish, which I think could kind of recap our discussion today. Mm-hmm. rule a big country the way you cook a small fish. If you keep control by following the way, troubled spirits won't act up. They won't lose their immaterial strength, but they won't harm people with it, nor will wise souls come to harm. And so, neither harming the other, these powers will come together in unity. So again, I thought that was a nice recap of many of our discussions today. And Le Guin says about this verse, she says, Thomas Jefferson would have liked the first stanza. And then she says, troubled spirits are quai, ghosts, not bad in themselves, but dangerous if they possess you. Whaley reads the second stanza as a warning to believers in real politic. A ruler possessed by power harms both the people and his own soul. Taking it as counsel to the individual, it might mean that wise souls neither indulge nor repress the troubled spirits that may haunt them. Rather, they let those spiritual energies be part of the power they find along the way. So I thought that was an interesting way to cap the conversation.
Had you chosen that before our conversation today, Jeffrey?
I had it at the beginning, but I didn't know where to place it in the conversation, so I waited for something to emerge.
It became an attractor for you, moving the system towards the omega point.
Although I was only going to read the first stanza, but the whole discussion was about harm and ghosts and so somehow the whole rest of it found its focus as well. So, yeah.
Very good, Jeffrey. Thank you for organizing it.
Thank you.
Thank you for helping with uploads and setting up events on the forum. And
Johnny, just so you know, I'll try my best, but it takes about maybe an hour for the video to process. But anyways,
take it.
And this is a good one.
We'll follow up with something. I'm not sure whether it'll be Bateson, as we discussed, but it seems like Simondon might be a good also way to go. We'd have to organize because finding texts of Simondon in English is tricky. So
very hard. I could only find one.
Yeah. So
it's that book on the animal and the man. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not the main point about individuation. It doesn't really deal with that. So, anyway, we'll leave it open for the time being, but I will organize and let you know on a follow-up discussion. And I'm open to suggestions too.
Yeah, I think many projects could emerge out of this.
It's been a wonderful group, and I'll maybe consult with Pat. She may have some ideas too.
Oh,
so,
I'm sure she will. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Heather.
Heather. Yeah, indeed. So thank you all.
Thank you all.
Pleasure.
Happy trails. See you around campus. Cosmic campus.
Bye. Bye.